Welcome to the For the Church podcast, another great gospel-centered resource from Midwestern Baptist Theological Seminary. My name is Jared Wilson. I'm an assistant professor of pastoral ministry and author in residence at Midwestern Seminary. And I'm here as always with my friend and my colleague and my co-host. He can pull off a kilt. Ross Ferguson.
I was waiting for the name. Let's make sure we get the name
in. We got the name in there. It's a household name, a brand name. Ross Ferguson.
Oh, that just a brand name makes me kind of squirm a little bit. I don't want to have a brand name.
You need
name.
Some branded, we need merch. Someone needs to do like a character of our faces and we can do like FTC podcast stickers and
don't
t-shirts.
You have a bobblehead?
I have a bobblehead.
That looks nothing like you.
I think it looks like me. It's a little thin. I like that. It was the good folks from, who was it? Focus on the Family. Yeah, Focus on the Family did these interview things and they gave me this bobblehead of myself, which I didn't know you could make such a thing. Mm-hmm. I assume you can make anything these days, but.
Have you not seen the Spurgeon bobbleheads?
Well, I know you could do that, but I didn't think you'd like make one for yourself. That's kind of weird. Like one, like they didn't make a bunch of them to sell. They made like this one bobblehead.
The bobbleheads in the Sword and Trial bookstore here of Spurgeon always make me laugh because they're on a circular table which has tiers. Okay. So it's like it can go from like the lower shelves maybe 2 feet off the ground, the highest shelf is 6 feet off the ground. So it kind of looks like a Christmas tree like, all the way up. And if you knock the table by accident, they all wobble. So I came in and said something like, I can't remember. It was like, what do you think, Spurgeon? Should we do this week? And he nudged the table and all the heads like shook.
It makes me think of like in Toy Story, all the little aliens in the arcade or whatever.
Yeah.
And all the little Spurgeon. I mentioned they were all Spurgeons. Like, oh, right in for the claw. Yeah. How you been, man? How's your family been?
We have had a very busy summer.
Okay.
Which has also culminated in birthdays for us.
Yeah, the twins turned 10?
Yeah. So I now have three kids in double digits, which kind of scares me. I was like, they've been alive for a decade. Am I old enough for kids as a decade? I am old enough for that. So yes, our twins turned 10. And we asked them what they wanted for their mm-hmm, birthday. Mm-hmm. And they said they really wanted to invite campus friends round and do a large slip and slide.
Okay.
So.
Oh, so not like the slip and slide you just buy in a box, some kind of industrial.
So the slip and slide you buy in a box would not cut it.
Okay.
So we had a tarp that was 100 meters long.
Okay.
And went down the steepest hill around the back of our house.
Okay.
Which also had soap all the way down it, water running it, and we were launching kids at full speed.
What's the tarp made of?
It was like just a black. Well, it wasn't really a tarp. It
like
was
garbage
like,
bag type material?
It was kind of like that, but like strong.
Stronger,
I think it's for gardening when you put it down to stop the weeds coming through. So it's almost like a rubberized thing.
Okay.
But it was pretty good. The downside was there was a concrete drain at the bottom of it. So kids did have to avoid the concrete drain, which they did.
Okay.
But the funniest moment for me was getting the like peer pressuring the older students to go down. So we had like 30 adults and maybe mm-hmm. 30, 40 kids from campus there. Uh-huh. Everyone's launching off. And so I would just see like an adult walk over and I would just point them out and go like, right, your turn. And I would get the whole, all the
You've
kids.
Been drafted.
I would literally get all the kids to start screaming their name so they couldn't say no.
It wouldn't be peer pressure. It would be because they're not their peers.
Well, I was pressured.
It'd be child pressure.
So we're like launching people down. And our very own Dr. Madsen.
Whoa.
He did not go down.
Oh.
I was like,
I got really excited.
So I was really
excited.
The idea
of Dr. Madsen going down.
He came up to see what was happening and I shouted over him. Yeah. I was like, Dr. Madsen, it's your turn to go down. Everyone's screaming like, go on, Dr. Madsen. And he just came up, went, have fun. And walked away.
I bet that dude don't even own a swimsuit.
I was so hoping
he does,
would
it's
go
one
down.
Of those kinds, like the onesie kind with the straps. It's like striped.
I could believe
like
that.
From the 1920s that they were at the beach.
That. Yeah. But we had a great fun doing it. And it was kind of one of those things of, you know, like go big or go home. Like we really went for it. And then right at the end, I managed to convince Miriam to go down at the same time as me. Miriam would never, Miriam's my wife. She would never go down these things. And we got the furthest. They soaked up, they put a ton of water on it and we went flying.
That's crazy.
Absolutely flying. What was not good after the slip and slide was I had spent basically 3 hours pushing kids down on floaties and different things and dragging them down, yeah. that by that night, my arms were so destroyed. Yeah. I was like so sore. And I don't know what it is about grass and wet that causes bugs in Missouri to come out.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
My legs look like they've been bitten 1,000 mm-hmm, times. Mm-hmm. So coming in at the end of the night, soaking wet, with my eyes stinging from soap, covered in bites.
How'd you dispose of the thing, the long thing? Did you?
Truth be told, it's still sitting behind our house. This is like weeks ago. Yeah. We haven't had the chance to go out. We folded it all up, and it's just this big pile of black tarp.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to bring that up. Your neighbors who are listening are probably like, yeah, he's got an eyesore back there.
Campus offices. Well, our AC stopped working, which is, I believe it's been fixed now. But the first thing we did was look outside to make sure the black tarp hadn't blown over or something like that. Okay. So we really should get it resolved. But for Leah's birthday, which is my eldest, at the recording of this episode, we haven't been to her birthday.
Okay.
But she would like to do one of the... I think they're called breakout rooms.
Oh, yeah.
Never done one of those as a family before. And she's really wanting to do one.
That's cool.
We might do that as a family. Gone are the days where we do little princess parties, which I am really glad for.
Good, okay.
Because that was not a fun season
for
me. Yeah,
they get older and they get cool. I mean, I think kids are always cool, but they get cool. You have cooler conversations with them. You can see how their little minds are growing and becoming little adults. And their personalities, how they get a little
they're
more
so different. Like for the twins, one of them wanted a bright red backpack to put all of her things in, like a little mini bag she could put on her back.
Uh-huh.
The other one wanted a new set of roller skates. So you'll know which one's which. And when we gave the new roller skates, we said, whatever you do,
is this Abby that does
Abby has the roller skates. Yeah, yeah. And I said to Abby, whatever you do, let's try and not scuff them up. A couple of nights
ago.
Did she
wear her other ones out? That's how much she used them?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, wow.
Oh, yeah. Like she like wore through them.
Okay.
So there's another hill on campus. And I walked out, I was on the phone. And I walked out and all I see, Abby, arms in the air, full pelt going down the hill, gets to the bottom, sees a rock, goes, oh no, does like a twist, scuffs her whole brand new set all the way around, stands up like a gymnast at the Olympics and goes, I'm fine. And then carries on. And I just turned around and went, I don't think it's good for me as a parent to watch this happening. So yeah, no, it's really exciting to see our girls grow up. And what's really incredible for us is because a lot of our time is spent in church ministry and campus ministry here, our girls are around a lot of young adult Christians. And at the twins' birthday, I think 15 of the students came out.
That's great.
And literally like young 20-year-old guys and girls training for ministry, going down a slip and slide at a 10-year-old's birthday party. Mm-hmm. And the thing I thought of, in the world, this would sound so strange, but this is what the Christian family looks like. These are their big brothers and sisters coming out to have fun. So yeah, that was good fun to see.
That's awesome.
I wasn't happy about the boys that bought them Nerf guns. So now Nerf bullets are flying all over our house.
Yeah. Nerf guns are fun. You know what else is fun? It's a mailbag.
It's a mailbag.
People like the mailbag. Well, I thought they did, but we didn't get as many submissions this time around.
Getting harder and harder questions.
The questions are getting harder and longer. Some of them are getting longer. They come with paragraphs of it.
Do you want to help people understand what would be a good way to submit
a
question?
It's a balance because sometimes somebody sends like a one-line question and there's not enough information. It's too broad.
But three paragraphs.
But sometimes when they
say
paragraphs and paragraphs, I'm thinking, well, I'm not sure. You know, we're the ones to really get at this.
It's like when you get to the end of three paragraphs and go, what's the question?
But there are a few of those. Here's my question. And there's not a question. There's not a single question
mark.
Here's
my question and the whole story. If you could answer this, that would be great. I don't know what you want.
Right. But in any event, I put a call out on social media, as I often do when we're going to record. Just not a whole lot of response to the social media this time around. I don't think anything from Twitter, but we were getting more and more people emailing their questions, which is great. And if you want to know, if you want a reminder, that email address is mailbag@ftc.co, not com, C-O. So it's mailbag@ftc.co. You can email your questions for the mailbag episodes anytime. Ross gets those. I'm sure he filters out the ones he doesn't want to answer and he forwards them to me. For some reason, I still cannot access them.
But we'll see those. Figure out.
Yeah. And let me know, because one question I have sometimes is when they email, I wonder if it's because they want to be anonymous, but none of these folks said, I want to be anonymous. So if you want to be anonymous, please make sure you make a note of that. Say, please don't use my name. All the folks that we have today who emailed, I'm using their names because they didn't say not to.
We're going
to
shout it from the rooftops.
Here we go. This comes from Tyler via email. Tyler says, I'm curious about theological unity on an elder board. Do you think elders should affirm a more narrow statement of faith than the rest of the church does? I'm also particularly curious about third tier issues like end times. We often talk about how the end times is a third tier issue and Christians are free to disagree, but I'm finding myself struggling to keep unity between older folks who were raised in dispensationalism and younger guys getting enamored with post-millennialism, neither of which I would affirm. Is it wise to guard the elder board by requiring a particular view on this matter in particular or any other third tier issues for that matter? And this is actually a really good question.
There's actually two questions in there. The first one being, should the elders be held to a stricter, to the congregation?
Should they have a narrower statement of faith than the congregation?
And
a lot of churches do. A lot of our friends have that.
So I would say no.
You'd say no. I think it's fine.
Yeah.
I don't think it's necessary.
That's the thing. I don't think it's necessary. Yeah. I don't think as a church you must have it strict. There might be at times that you need it, but I don't think it's necessary. So then the next question is...
Well, let's talk about the reasons why people who do that. And I totally understand why. It's so that there is teaching unity.
Yes.
So we want a narrower statement of faith. So let's say a church, and this is very common, especially friends that we have, brothers that we know that we love and respect. Their church may, for instance, be organized around the Baptist Faith and Message 2000.
Yes.
So to be a member of the church, you must affirm the Baptist Faith and Message 2000. To be an elder at the church, you must affirm the Baptist Faith and Message 2000. And also, I don't know, the London Baptist Confession, the 1689, that sort of thing, the Second London Baptist Confession, something like that. And it's a narrower statement of faith. And the reason for that is not just because elders are called to a higher standard in terms of theological rigor and that sort of thing, but so that you don't have two guys who are teaching in two different arenas in the church giving two different perspectives on a particular thing. And I'm assuming that can be an issue with what our friend Tyler here is talking about. If he's got – and I'm assuming the brothers he's speaking of, an older folks who are dispensational and younger guys who are post-mill, if they're elders, as he's framed this, you've got one elder who's teaching on end times and he's teaching it from a dispensational perspective, and you got another elder teaching on end times and he's – teaching it from a post-millennial perspective, you have members going, wait, hold on, pastors are not in agreement on this. And so that would be why a lot of churches say our elders are going to subscribe to a narrower statement of faith so that we have unity that doesn't cause confusion among members when it comes to the teaching perspective. So we wouldn't say to a member, you must be post-mill, but we're going to say to our elders, we all need to be post-mill so that we are teaching the same thing when it comes to that issue. It's sounding like you and I would say, that's fine, but it's not necessary.
Yeah, I don't think you have to have that.
And I agree.
And I think it's also going to be a little bit dependent on who your elders are. Because if you have elders that are essentially amenable in their disagreement, because actually disagreement is not wrong. It's when disagreement leads to conflict that it becomes wrong. And I can think of a situation where a brother and I disagree on female deacons. Like we literally sit on opposite sides. It really doesn't come between us. It's just been a discussion. We occasionally debate it every so often, but we'd be amenable to it. And if I taught it, I would say, hey, there's others that would see it this way. And I'm pretty sure that when he teaches it, he would be the same, that there is other views to this. So I think it also slightly depends. And that's kind of a stronger lead into his second question, which is really, do you need to have like-minded elders coming on board?
Yeah.
And I want to say, yes, that is helpful But it can also be unhelpful because you don't see the other side of it as well. And I think what is more helpful is that you have elders that are amenable to discussion and debate and delving deep into things and would be content to be able to say, hey, this is where I lean on this view, but there are other brothers that would lean slightly differently. I'm sure they can help unpack that a little bit more for you. So I would say it's more about getting like-minded elders in attitude to their service to the church rather than necessarily doctrine. And just caveat that a little bit, significant agreement needs to be in place.
Yeah.
You can't really be an elder in a Baptist church and then walk down the street and go to a Presbyterian church saying, I'm like-minded, let's go together. And what I'm talking about is when you're sitting in your church, your church doctrines have been in place and that brother just leans to a different perspective than you. I think that's okay on the non-primary issues. And these third tier issues, even to some extent, I would lean to you could possibly disagree on second tier issues. It's how you handle that.
Yeah.
And I'm saying possibly. I guess I'm just opening the door a little bit for...
Like what, for example?
So the Lord's Supper, we've done an episode on that. Who gets to take the Lord's Supper? Some may place that in third or second tier, depending on how you view it. I think you can disagree on a closed table, close table, open table, and still serve alongside each other.
Yeah. I'm a little more, I think we need to be unanimous in those things because it has so much to do with how the church is run or organized, you know? So I would tend to think like core Christian theology, first tier, without question, we need to be, because that's what makes us Christian or not.
Yeah.
And then second tier issues relate to how the church is organized or how the church functions. So even things like ministry philosophy, I think you need to be on the same page. You might disagree with some jot and tittles on, you know, but in terms of like, you know, how liturgy should be expressed and who's going to lead in certain things and who's qualified to lead.
Yeah.
And just in terms, and even like approach to even preaching and those sorts of things, I think those are set, you know, how a church is organized and we ought to have, you know, be on the same page there. But when it comes to the third tier issues, I think it's fine to have disagreement so long as each person holds that as a third tier issue.
Yes.
And so when he says something like, I've got younger guys getting enamored with post-mill.
Yeah.
It wouldn't bother me if a guy was post-mill so long as he held it as a third tier issue and wasn't insisting that someone else is a lesser Christian for not sharing that view. And when he presents that view, as you said, is saying, hey, this is, you know, we have a variety of views on this among the elder board. You don't have to be post-mill to be a member here. Here's what, you know, the case that I would make for it, et cetera. But if you disagree, we can still be in unity. Those sorts of things. I think as long as they're actually treating it like a third tier issue. I remember, you know, when I was establishing elders at my last church and the previous pastor, he had retired and he and his wife were still members of the church. I wanted him to be a lay elder in the church. He's clearly qualified. He'd been the pastor for 10 years before me. And I just thought, and he was a great brother and we had a great relationship. I had no concerns at all about him, you know, trying to steer things or people looking to him more than me or anything. I mean, all of that was really clean and clear and great. He declined. And in the first, in my first sort of invitation to be considered for the elder board, because he could see I was preaching from a Reformed perspective and he did not share that perspective. And he thought it would be, he said, I think it's important that elders have the same viewpoint on those things. So on one level, it was like very humble of him to say, I don't think I should be an elder because it would be confusing for the church if we taught from two different perspectives on that matter. I disagreed with him.
Yeah.
I thought, no, like it's not core for our church. Mm. You have to be a Calvinist or you got to be Reformed. And, you know, certainly I didn't think I was wearing it on my shirt sleeves really, but I thought we could have elders who had, and we did have a diversity of views on that issue. But he wasn't among them because he did not feel comfortable. He thought we all need to be on the same page there.
But even in that attitude, you're seeing somebody that's actually producing that elder quality because they're saying, Actually, I don't know if this is right, that because I think I might butt against you in these things.
Yeah.
So even like that's talking to the attitude of the type of person that actually they'll count themselves out of the running to make sure the unity of the team
yeah,
is there.
That's true, yeah.
So, you know, so I think what we're saying is it's not necessary to be on exactly the same page, but you do want to be as close as you possibly can
yes.
be and watch your attitudes just as leaders. But if you raise a third tier issue into second tier, but you're verbally saying third tier, you might want to check that before you join a team.
That's good. Okay, this comes from Daniel via Facebook. Daniel says, I'd love to hear some discussion about a calling to ministry in general versus a calling to a specific ministry. In other words, it's not just, I believe the Lord has called me to ministry, but the Lord has called me to minister to these people in this place or to this particular kind of ministry.
Yeah.
My answer is really simple. And so I'll give it really quick. And then if you've got something you want to expand upon, you can. I think there's a biblical category. Sometimes we make this too mystical, but I think there's a biblical category for a call to ministry, which I take as a call to pursue the qualifications, 1 Timothy 3, et cetera, or to maintain the qualifications if you're already qualified, a call to pursue those in service of the church. So in some ways, the call biblically is a call to a house. Here's the people of God.
Mm.
When you get to that house, for specific people, certain doors might be open and unlocked and other ones may not be. I don't think there's anything necessarily that we need to be dogmatic about or biblically narrow about a specific ministry. I think that all just falls down to a combination of somebody's wiring and interest, where somebody may feel like, I'm called to ministry. I seem to have a good rapport with students, and I really enjoy being with students. And there's when I approach the idea of ministry, the doors that are open to me are doors with student ministry, and I'm going to walk through that door. It's a combination of your wiring, your interest, your experience, perhaps your training. Yeah, your training, your education, but also circumstances. What doors are open to you? I don't think it's any more mystical necessarily than that. If the Lord's called you to ministry, go towards ministry, see what doors are open to you that you want to walk through, and I think you can walk through those doors.
Yep. I think I would be in agreement with that. And I think the only thing I would say is I've seen this occur on the negative side where somebody on both sides, I'm called to ministry, but I don't really know which causes them to kind of languish in this unknown and they don't actually kind of do anything with it.
Okay.
And I've definitely seen people that, for instance, at the seminary, just study multiple degrees because actually they don't really know where am I meant to use this. And they end up just getting on a train of just doing the same things over and over again, and they have no focus to it. So what I would say is, even if you're called generally to ministry, and you see it as a general ministry of encouragement to those that are training into ministry, then actually do that. Don't just say, I don't have a specific ministry. Actually, you kind of do. It's general, but do it. Don't just sit there going, well, I don't have a particular thing.
Yeah.
On the flip side, I've seen guys that have been so particular, but nothing's opened up that they still say, but that's what God wants of me. So they'll say things like, I'm called to pastoral ministry to Kansas City and no church has interviewed me. I can't find a job. No one wants me. I can't find one for the money in the location. And they spend like 4 years looking for it and essentially grumble the fact that, you know, churches don't are not wanting pastor, you know, da, 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 da. If the door isn't opening, is it actually that specific ministry you've been called to? And I would say just test what you define as that's where God has called me to go.
See, now it's dawning on me that that's what Daniel meant, that you read the question right. I was thinking specific ministry in terms of like a category of ministry. You were thinking in terms of like the actual circumstance. I'm called to this church or this city.
Or I'm just called to pastor wherever the Lord puts me, or I'm called specifically to New England, or I'm called specifically to this church in this location.
That's a good
And I'm not going to go anywhere else. And all I would say is there's just two sides of that. If you are called to, quote, Kansas City, then you might be prepared, you might have to be prepared to do it on a lower salary, yeah, or in a worse house or in a bad area, where I've literally heard people say, I've been called to Kansas City, but I've rejected these two churches because they're not in a great area to raise a family. And you're sitting there going, so you're not called to Kansas City, you're called, yeah, to the nice parts of Kansas City. So it's just like,
whoa, boom.
You just got to, what I'm saying is, yeah, test these things. Like, yeah, is this actually a specific calling? Is it actually a general calling?
I still have a, yeah, pretty short answer now that I've sort of seen the question reframed in my mind. And I think you probably read it correctly. And I did not. I was thinking specific ministry, like, oh, I'm going to go work in a campus ministry, or I'm going to go work in this particular role in a church or something like that. But it's sort of to a specific church or location or something. My answer is still pretty simple, I suppose, which is, where are the circumstances, where are the doors opening, and do you want to do it?
Yeah.
I don't think it's any more supernatural than that. I remember speaking to a brother, you know, once upon a time, who was really trying to get into foreign missions, and they were working with a sending agency, and nothing was working out. I think they even had some bad connections there. The guy that was overseeing them was just not doing well, but a number of years went by. They felt like they were in this holding pattern, and during that time, he began to feel this draw towards pastoring a local church. Mm-hmm. And he was really torn and just thought, am I giving up on this dream that I've talked a big deal about now? But I really think the Lord, mm-hmm, is tugging me in this regard. And there was no question he's called to ministry.
Yes.
Generally, he's qualified and he wanted to preach the word, et cetera. But now he's beginning to think, I think I might want to pastor a church. And so, I'm talking to him on the phone and he's asking me, like, what should I do? And like, my brother, like, I can't tell you. Like, yeah, I'm not God. I don't know, like, if you're in sin to do this, yeah, or that. But I just said, I don't know that it's more complicated than, like, if you could snap your fingers and tomorrow have exactly what you want, what would it be? And he said, I would be pastoring a church. And I said, that's what you should do, yeah, then.
Move towards that.
Give up the idea that you need to go overseas unless the Lord just immediately opens a door that changes your, yeah, heart. But if your desire, and it's a good golly desire, it's not, mm, a sinful thing, your desire is to shepherd a local flock, man, go do that.
Yeah.
God put that in your heart. You can trust that, I think.
And if you're going to a specific ministry and you arrive there and it's really hard,
maybe God called you to that anyway.
To a really hard ministry.
That's right. All right. This comes from Kenny via email. Kenny says, from young children through senior adults, it's challenging to find qualified lay Sunday school teachers. Obviously, we need a high standard, but especially in smaller churches, the struggle is real. I know the qualifications might be different from age group to age group, but can you talk about the vetting process, mm-hmm, that you'd recommend? So how do you find qualified, we'll just say small group teachers, Sunday school teachers, yeah, class teachers in the church? Smaller church, man, slim pickings. In some ways, this is the same situation. Like, how do you find qualified elders? How do you find,
yeah,
et cetera?
It's kind of the same type of question.
Yeah. And, you know, the one thing I would say, Kenny, is like, if you need to rethink, you know, based on the personnel that you've got, if you need in the interim to rethink how classes are done, maybe you don't need an individual class for every age group. Maybe you bunch some things up.
Yep.
So instead of looking for 10 teachers, you're really now just looking for 3 or 4. Rethink how you can frame these things in the interim. And then I think one thing to really get serious about is some kind of leadership pipeline.
Yeah.
So not just vetting who you've got. Are you good? Are you good? Are you good? But how do you help people get good who may be interested, yep, and weed out people who, you know, don't have what it takes? Create a class, some sort of training program, maybe a group. I mean, I remember when I was looking for small group leaders at my last church, and I had guys I thought would be really good at it, but I just thought, let's do a small group together for 6 months so that I can model for them what I want our small, yep, groups to look like. And so the guys in my small group were all future small group leaders. Yep. And I thought, this is how I'm quote unquote vetting this, is we're just going to run through the experience of being in a small group together, mm-hmm, so that you can replicate kind of the vision that, and yeah, you may need to do that. Do some kind of training. This is what Sunday school teaching should be like.
Yeah.
This is how to do it. If, you know, what you want to see, invest in that. And in the meantime, maybe you need to put your vision a little smaller in terms, mm-hmm, of how many teachers you might need.
Yeah, I would also just counsel, you don't have to have a Sunday school.
Okay.
You don't have to have
it. Man, kill that cow.
For instance, in the UK, there is not a single church I'm aware of that does an adult Sunday school, because it is a distinctly kind of an American thing that I've seen. So you don't have to have it. Now, children's work generally, that is really, really good to have. And so what I would be saying is if you are seeing an issue here, push more towards the children and less towards the adults, because you can give them other things. You can give them preaching. You can visit them. You can have other ways of inputting knowledge into them. So number one, know that this doesn't have to be a sacred cow. You can actually cancel off a ministry. Number two, it might be worth going for the next 6 months. We're not going to have Sunday school. Instead, we're going to have Sunday school training. And we're going to ask all our members that potentially could be interested in being involved to come along. And we're going to go through what it means to teach. What are we going to teach? What's the principles? All of these sorts of things. And then at the end of that 6 months, you sit down with your fellow leaders and go, who's showing us the aptitude, the attitude, the desire to do it? And then maybe relaunch your ministries again. Church revitalization, small church I was involved in. We had no youth leaders for youth. So we canceled our youth ministries because it was a real problem. We didn't have anyone to do it. We spent 2 years developing people that could be youth leaders and then relaunched youth.
You know, this is really connected. This is a whole other issue, but that just reminds me, like, I mean, there is a philosophy of thinking we don't have a youth group. Therefore, we need to hire a youth pastor to create a youth group.
Yeah.
Versus the idea of like, we've got a lot of youth, we should hire a youth pastor. And those are two different philosophies of ministry. Yeah. So your philosophy essentially, like, if you can't find the people, is just, you just
don't
kill
do
the
it.
Thing.
I'm saying,
lunch is canceled due to lack of hustle.
Well, here's the thing. He might have no Sunday school teachers, but he might have a bunch of people that are really into hospitality.
Oh, sure.
So shift it from an early Sunday school and a service to a service.
I know, but this is such an outsider perspective, Ross. I'm picturing, I don't know this brother, but if he's at a smaller church, I'm picturing that he's at a place like, if he said, you know what, we're not doing Sunday school.
He's fired.
He would be fired. But I think in general, I think you're right. If you're able to just say, hey, you know, we don't have the personnel for this, or maybe you just do one class.
Yeah.
You know,
combine all together.
The church I just spoke at, they have one adult class and then one of the pastors, you know, teaches that. And you just scale to the personnel that you have. So, all right. This comes from Carrie via Facebook. Carrie says, what specific reasons are you seeing for the continual challenges in churches finding youth pastors? All right. Specific reasons for the continual challenges in churches finding youth pastors. Now, you're in this field of this placement. I'm going to give two theories, and then you tell me whether either one or both are okay or not.
Or you're wrong.
And expand. So my two theories are, number one, most guys who would be youth pastor qualified are actually more interested in being associate pastors or lead pastors.
Correct.
And so just the youth pastor job is not as appealing as it might have been 10, 20 years ago.
Correct.
People have seen it as, oh, this is really just a rung on the ladder and I don't want to be, if I can skip that rung, why not just go on to the next rung? I think the other thing may be, and I know we maybe have some disagreement here, but some of the data is showing that the average age of pastor is increasing. There's just maybe fewer guys, just fewer people going into ministry. I know in our circles, that doesn't make sense because everyone's going into ministry. But across the board, if you're just looking at the job market, there's fewer young men going into pastoral ministry. Therefore, there's just fewer people to draw from. Those would be the only two things that I would offer.
I would add two to that. So I think the first one's definitely correct in terms of they're just not actually wanting youth ministry. Mm-hmm. Number two, I think within our tribe, we're not seeing a reduction in training and desire generally for ministry. But I think out with of our tribe, that might be true. But the third one I would add to that is the churches want too much from their youth pastor in terms of training, in terms of hours, and they're usually not willing to pay them for that. So they'll be like, you're the junior guy, you get paid 50% that the senior guy gets, and we want 45 hours in every ministry under the sun to be catered for. Oh, and by the way, we want an MDiv and you're working towards your PhD.
Yeah.
It's just too much. Now, what I caveat that, you shouldn't just let any old person in, but recognize that you shouldn't really be asking for this guy to have spent 10 years training at seminary and have 7 years experience. More often than not, youth ministry is younger guys with less experience and less knowledge. Therefore, you have to be ready to accept that type of guy because that's what comes through, which then comes to my fourth point, which is how churches treat youth pastors. Specifically, that they're a dime a dozen, and if we don't like him, he can just go.
Yeah.
So I actually have to care for them. This is a young guy who potentially one day might become a senior pastor, and that might be dependent on how you treat him. Do you care for him? Do you love him? Do you love his wife? Do you love his family?
Do you have his back?
Exactly. Yeah. When the parents go absolutely crazy at the cost of the camp, yeah. are you going to stand behind him?
Yeah.
And I think that those two things go hand in hand, what you expect of him and how you treat him. And then the final thing is we need to stop looking outside our own churches for the youth pastors. Look within. So what 20-year-old guy do you have in your church right now? What 25-year-old girl do you have in your church right now that you could say, hey, we've got 10 teenage girls. We really need to care for them. Who do we think could do that? We have, 14 teenagers. Is there a young guy that desires ministry that we could say internally, we'll pay for your classes, but we would love to see you work within this area? And then guess what? There is no search committee. You're not searching for the guy. You're training the person within. And that, I think, is a far better model to find someone for your youth work. And if you're saying there's nobody in your church, nobody that would have a desire to do the youth work, like literally none, I'm kind of drawing a question as to why you're hiring a youth pastor. Like, does your church really want youth ministry in your church? So I'm just very conscious at Liberty. There's multiple guys we have that are involved in youth ministry, and some of them are PhD, some of them have none of those degrees, but we're saying, we trust you. You're members of our church. We've witnessed your behavior. We see your desire. To some extent, we trust you enough to let you go and start ministry with our young people. No search committee, no issues there. And then you train within. So I think when you add all that together, I think it is less about the guy going to ministry wanting youth. And I think it's a lot more about generally how the church views that role, views that person, and plans that ministry out.
Well, and on that note, I thought of two other things as you were talking that are related to what you just said. I think a lot, and Carrie, I don't know anything about necessarily where you're at. I think I know this brother, but I'm not saying this is true of your church, but just in general, one of the phenomenons is like, if I'm a guy looking to go into ministry and I'm looking at the youth ministry option, you know, the open positions, it's very typically in a lot of churches, youth plus music.
Yes.
We want a youth slash worship pastor slash children's minister.
Slash missions.
Slash whatever.
Administration.
And the guy's like, well, okay, so basically I'm going to be a, you know, four quadrant guy, all over the place. It's sort of a catch-all. You basically created a junk drawer position. We can't afford to just pay a full-time youth guy. So we're going to throw these up, you know, package it all together.
Yeah.
And we're looking for a unicorn, someone who,
and
more often than not, what you end up with is a guy who's really good at one of those things and does the other things in a poor way.
Which is often not youth. He's usually really good at other things.
Yes, exactly.
And youth is his
weaker
spot.
He's a worship guy who's having to do youth or some other thing. And so there's a lot of guys who's just like, they're not willing to do that. It's like, I'd rather go be a lead pastor or an associate pastor where I have a defined role. There's a, you know, full-time for this position, rather than some kind of, you know, stepbrother type, you know, junk drawer thing. And the other thing I think too is it somewhat related, and we kind of touched on, is like, is there authority in this role, or is it sort of like you're a junior minister kind of thing? I think there's a lot of guys, especially seminary guys, that are thinking like, I don't want to go and be in a position where I've got the pressure of parents, but I'm not an elder. I'm not actually a pastor, so I don't have authority pastorally. And so now I've got the pressure of the pastors and I'm in this, I mean, it's just so common. You're between a rock and a hard place where, you know, you're having to kind of keep the, you know, customers happy, but you got, you know, CEOs that are coming down on you for, you know, why aren't you keeping the parents happy?
Yeah.
And no one wants to sign up for that. It's a very common experience. And there's guys that just know that's the experience. And so I think one of the things you could do as a solution is really have a defined role, really give not just responsibility, but authority. If you're going to call someone a youth pastor, this is just, again, to get into ecclesiology here. If you're going to call someone a youth pastor, he needs to have pastoral authority.
Yes.
He should be an elder of the church, et cetera. If he's not an elder in the church, call him something else, director of student ministry or something. But just have it really defined. And make sure whatever responsibility you give him some authority as well, and support, that he knows that he has your support. So I think some of those things are probably a combination of why We're just seeing a decline or challenges in finding youth pastors. Okay, finally, this comes from Doug via email. Doug is asking about modern missionaries and modern missions. He says, my question is about the modern need for missionaries to be sent around the globe. In light of increasing danger of international life, it seems to me that sending missionaries into harm's way is reckless and irresponsible. Now we can communicate with nearly anyone on the globe with any form of electronic means. Sending young people where they don't speak the language or culture seems so counterintuitive to ways we communicate nowadays. If the argument is made that we need personal interaction with a future pastor or church plant leaders, let's use our mission dollars to bring them to the U.S. for training and guidance and programs like the Pastor Training Center. He's speaking of the Pastoral Training Center at Liberty Baptist Church. He says, I've been in the church all of my life and always held mission work in high regard, but it seems there are better, safer, and more efficient ways to accomplish the spread of the gospel without putting young lives at severe risk. Thank you, Doug, for the question. Several things in here. The first thing I would say is that, I think concern about life and about danger and about the risk to life is a good and sincere concern. Mm-hmm. I'm not aware of a missions agency, including the ones that send people into very dangerous places, that aren't thinking about how to mitigate some of those risks, or all of them if possible. I mean, you can't mitigate all risks, but even the ones who send people into quote-unquote harm's way have protocol in place. But there's a few things on here that I just think, Doug, may be a little misconstrued or maybe misunderstood. First of all, the idea of like sending people where they don't speak the language or culture, I'm not aware of missions agencies that do that. I'm sure maybe there's some individual missionaries that go places where they're going to, be among people whose language they don't know and culture.
Short-term missions could maybe accused of that.
But I don't think that's what Doug has in mind.
But usually on short-term missions, you would have somebody that would speak the language and others that don't.
I mean, the IMB puts people through language school. You continue to learn the language even after you have the basics. You continue to grow in your language school and you have cultural training as well.
Yeah, I have a friend in Papua New Guinea that he knows I think it's called like the pidgin language, which is the general language of the area, and then has spent years learning the specific tribal language. So yeah, I wouldn't necessarily say that language really is a true barrier to missions in the modern day. I think we have mission societies that are actively working to ensure
that.
What
about this idea then about, okay, we can communicate with nearly anyone on the globe with electronic means. And so instead of sending people, why can't we just beam satellite messages or satellite training into thing? I think you and I both would agree that not every context has access to laptops or phones or electricity even and to receive these sort of communications. The idea that then instead of going, we would bring people from these contexts over here for training. First of all, if you're thinking about like unreached people groups, some of the most dangerous places, which would be the ones that we're theoretically trying to avoid harm, are unreached places. Yeah. There is no necessarily significant gospel presence there. You can't really bring people there here, aside from like, human trafficking. Instead of like, you could kidnap them, I suppose.
I think it's also...
But you can't reach them without going.
Yeah, potentially a misunderstanding of what the world looks like. So I'm aware of a student here on campus, to protect them, I won't say where they came from, but they came from what you would assume was a developing country, not developed, but a developing country. This student had never been on a flight and had spent years raising the money to be on the flight to come here. And that is in a developing country. We haven't even talked about the third world, where some of them don't even know there is such a thing as planes.
Yeah, yeah.
And even if there was, there's no way they could have the money or the resources. And even if we sent the money, they don't have bank accounts. They don't have ways to receive the money.
Yeah.
They wouldn't even know that. Even just different cultures. I had Nigerian folks in my previous church. Different cultures work on different times. So, and like if you said 10 a.m., they'll turn up when they turn up because it's African time. Do you know, is that kind of I think it's just a naiveness to what the world looks like.
Yeah.
And if I say it this way, I try not to be offensive, but the world doesn't look like America. It doesn't have the resources we have. And you could say, well, we could just give them and then they could use them. but you're assuming that we can even give them. You're assuming that we can even reach them to give them. You're assuming that they have electricity to be able to use it. You're assuming in some places, like friends of mine in Papua New Guinea, they've never seen any form of transport other than a motorbike. That's it.
Yeah.
They've never seen a car. They've never seen a van, never seen a plane. So to just assume that everything's going to be fine to bring them here, I think it's just naive to think along those lines.
Yeah. I've got three, I don't know if you call them theological, but three just sort of responses, I think, just in terms of like, why not just send electronic means or some other books or something like that? And as you mentioned, you know, you can't send books to places where they don't read certain languages, or they don't have a written language, or whatever. In any event, if it's an unreached group and some book arrives that's talking something where they're just not going to be interested. Number one, Jesus said, go.
Yeah, great commission.
Go, therefore, into all the world. Mm-hmm. And certainly I think that it can include creating resources that you can send instead of people, but I don't think it's instead of people. I think it's along with.
It's along with.
It's as a supplement. Certainly, I think I'm grateful for electronic communication, that you can satellite messages places or send them videos or send them phones with preloaded clips of the Jesus film or whatever it is. There's all kinds of things that missions organizations are doing. They're doing all these things. But the bottom line is Jesus said, go into all the world and make disciples of all nations. And so to be obedient to that, we don't say, well, I don't really want to go. It's too dangerous. I'm going to send stuff and said, no, he said, go. The church need to obey the command to go. Secondly, I think there is a beauty, according to the New Testament portrait, to incarnational ministry, life-on-life discipleship, being an example to the flock, the kind of training we need to do contextually for pastors and for churches means getting up close, breaking bread with people, sharing lives with them, experiencing what they experience. Mm-hmm. For the same reason that our local church doesn't say, hey, everybody stay home. We're just going to tune in on Zoom this Sunday and we'll send you what you need to know via electronic means.
Yeah.
But we use electronic means as we can, but we say, we're going to gather. We're not going to forsake the gathering. When we're going to meet with people, we're going to actually meet with people. Sometimes you got to do a phone call. Sometimes you got to send an email. But to the best of our ability, we see physical presence as not just psychologically beneficial, but beneficial, but theologically meaningful. We learned this during COVID, I think, how important it is to sit across the table, to hear each other's voices, to see posture and to be in one another's lives, to share hospitality. And so to pass on Christianity, particularly in places that do not have a lot of Christianity, you have to model it and live it incarnationally. Jesus did this. He didn't just send and beam down a message to us. He came down and Doug and anyone else listening, he came down at the risk of his incarnated life.
Yeah.
He could have avoided harm's way, but he was incarnational. And I just think that's so important to missional work, is being present. And then thirdly and finally is really related to that. To model Christianity is to lay down our lives.
Yes.
Can we mitigate risks? If we can, sure, we should. None of us want to see young missionaries or any missionaries lose their lives. But Jesus came and laid down his life so that others would see that God loves them. And so the model he's given us is to take up our cross. You know, we've been preaching through the book of Acts at Liberty Baptist Church, and what we see over and over again is there are things that are more important than safety.
Yeah.
And the thing that is more important than safety is that people would hear the good news of Jesus and live. And sometimes the Lord has ordained that would require the spending of our lives.
Yeah.
It would require the spending of our lives to adorn that gospel. Mm. And while we should avoid that, and certainly if my child was a missionary, I would be so worried for them and I would be praying my guts out for their safety. I could also see that there are some things more precious. I would hope the Lord would give me the grace to know that there are some things more precious. Mm-hmm. Someone's eternal life is more precious than the temporary physical life that we can't hold on to anyway.
I just think all of that can be summed up in Romans 10, famous passage. We kind of know this. How then will they call on him whom they have believed? And it builds all the way through to, and how are they to hear without someone preaching? And how are they to preach unless they are sent? So it's not unless the message is sent, unless the actual preacher said they are sent. And then what is really wonderful is verse 15 continues, how beautiful are the feet of those who preach the good news. Mm. It's not how beautiful the preaching is or how beautiful the sharing of technology is or how beautiful the ministry methodology is. It's how beautiful the feet are of those who are sent to preach the words. And so I would say, as much as we're trying to pragmatically manage missions, we should not forget the beauty that is to lay one's life down for the sake of the gospel as we take that name out. And I would say there are dangerous places in the world to go to as missionaries. There's also danger right outside your front door. It's just as dangerous in some senses to speak to your neighbor who's an atheist, who's so anti-God, he's furious about it, as to somebody that goes over to the other side of the world to do it. And we just need to always remember that it is a beautiful mission goal to take the gospel wherever we are.
Yeah, it's good. Doug, hope that addressed your question well. If you have questions, anybody, dear listener, if you have good questions for us, well, maybe you think they're good and we don't think they're good. If you have a question, I'll put it that way, you have a question you'd like us to answer on the mailbag, you can send it to mailbag@ftc.co anytime, mailbag@ftc.co. Otherwise, look for the little announcements on Twitter and Facebook where we ask for questions and give us some good fodder for the next mailbag. And until next time, may Jesus be big in your church. You've been listening to the For the Church podcast, hosted by Jared Wilson, found online at ftc.co. This resource is brought to you by Midwestern Baptist Theological Seminary in Kansas City, Missouri, where we train leaders for the church.